From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I do have this memory of looking out the car window while it was raining and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool to control the rain?
Do you really want to get in a hole just for the pleasure of having a nice takeaway on a Tuesday night?
Obviously, you know, you're not really aware of it as you're living your life, but your voice gets deeper and deeper and deeper as you get older.
Coming up on this Many Shades of Grey edition of Playback Daily: Rain Woman, how romanticy can keep the clouds at bay. Debt comes to us all. Burgers on the Never Never. And Jarvis Cocker on gradually turning into Barry White. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that always keeps the clouds at bay. Unless you want clouds. Do you want clouds? I could get you clouds. Let's get started with the Oliver Callan morning monologue and Dermot Whelan sitting in for Oliver, telling us how he almost wasn't sitting in for Oliver this morning.
You know that awful feeling when the alarm goes off and you turn it off? I didn't hit snooze, and then I went into like the deepest sleep imaginable, and managed to have one of those recurring dreams, a recurring dream that I've had since I was a kid. And I grew up in County Limerick, and I grew up near a golf club, and I used to look for golf balls at a particular bend in the road. This is life before PlayStations, folks. And that was how we spent our time. And then, of course, you'd go up and you'd sell the golf balls back to the people who lost them in the first place. But ever since then, I have had a recurring dream that I'm back in that very part, that little piece of Limerick Highway or byway, and I'm looking for those golf balls again, and I find a load of them. And then next thing I wake up, thankfully I woke up in time. But you know what, as I was driving to work, I came over the East Link Bridge in Dublin, and I was listening to all the news, and it all seemed so dark and crazy, and the riots in California and people trying to get aid to Gaza and murders and housing crisis and rubber bullets and tear gas. And I thought, you know what, this is a lot to be dealing with. We've a lot to be dealing with. Our nervous systems have a lot to be taken on board these days. But then I looked to my left and I saw a couple saying goodbye to each other at the barrier along the Liffey there, just after the bridge, with all the boats behind them. And the man, who looked about 30, he just suddenly picked up his girlfriend into his arms in a kind of a swashbuckling romantic way, maybe romanticy, and lifted her over the barrier and gently placed her down on the other side. And I don't know why he did it. She didn't seem heavily pregnant to me or wearing any particularly difficult high heels or anything. So I'm not sure why he did it, but he placed her down gently on the other side. And then they kissed and hugged, and then she walked away with a big smile on her face. So I think it was just a little lovely moment to remind ourselves that amongst all this hard stuff we have to listen to every day, there are these little snapshots of beauty and love and romantic gestures over road barriers.
Oh, amidst all the carnage, there's still some pockets of love in the world. They'll probably be arrested for something. I mean, we can't have public displays of affection going on in that part of the country. You never know what it might inspire. Meanwhile, Dermot's sporting moment of the weekend didn't involve the players who served up such an epic Munster final. It was more a tribute to one of RTE's own GAA legends.
I think the toughest job in sport, in my opinion, belongs to the legendary Marty Morrissey. He has the unenviable job of conducting interviews outside sporting stadiums before matches, doing his best to chat to former players and pundits and get their nuggets of expertise, all while surrounded by ecstatic fans behind him contorting their bodies to get into the shot like some weird game of Twister in Ga jerseys. And all of this, of course, is happening terrifyingly live. And when Marty was talking, when I was watching him before the Limerick Cork match outside the Gaelic grounds there in Limerick, and when Marty was talking, after a hand emerged from the human soup behind him and just plonked a red bucket hat right on top of his head. Now, of course, at this moment, you could see on Marty's face that he had no idea what they had just put on his head. It could have been anything. It could have been a Viking themed horned helmet or something with a rude slogan across it. But he couldn't freak out in the moment and reef it off his head in panic. So with a very deft movement, the true professional that he is, he cracked a joke with the player he was talking to. And in one movement, he patted him on the shoulder. And then with the slickness of a Keith Barry card trick, he removed the hat, examined it to make sure he hadn't been brandishing anything embarrassing, and then neatly handed it back to the public. What a pro. After my days presenting the Republic of Telly and our 24-hour camera we used to bring around from town to town in a horse box, I have seen firsthand what kind of horrors can unfold when the public are let loose in front of a camera. And that wasn't even live. Including the time I remember when the entire horse box, the Republic of Telly horse box, was stolen and rolled down a hill in Waterford with our poor unsuspecting cameraman still inside. So I think Marty is the only man I would trust to handle any situation thrown at him. And I hope he's receiving the appropriate danger money for doing it as well.
After Marty's heroics, Dermot did turn his attention briefly to the actual game that took place under the gaze of the bowled Mr. Morrissey.
It was a wild match though, wasn't it? Into extra time and then penalties. Referee Thomas Tyler Walsh, it was so intense even the ref went down with cramp, as we can hear.
And now Tyler Walsh has gone down with an injury. Obviously he's got a cramp and Adam English is doing the physiotherapy work. And it's the referee that is experiencing.
And referees are you don't realise, the referees are travelling 11, 12 kilometres in all the games.
Yeah, so that was more excitement on the day. And actually, I heard Kilkenny legend Tommy Walsh, another Thomas Walsh, talking after the game. And he remarked how sometimes we can forget that these days are equally big for the referee and the match officials as well. I mean, these are the big days they've been working towards, just like the players. All those minor games in backfields and driving drizzle have been building towards this. So to have to go off with cramp or any kind of an injury, I'm sure was disappointing for him too, particularly as such a crucial part of the game too. It was funny to see his cramp being alleviated by Adam English. Not that that gesture of kindness helped referee decisions go Limerick's way, mind, according to most Limerick fans. Didn't think it did anything. Cork ended up winning the penalty shootout 3-2 to be crowned Munster champs. Highly unusual for hurling. God love the rec players stepping up to take those. The days of the replay are no more. And the championship calendar doesn't allow it. And in a way, I feel, you know, when you're thinking about it, you think the GAA, they can't really win. You know, if Cork Limerick went to a rematch, there'd be all the old talk about, sure, it's just a money-generating exercise. And they're probably in on it. They're probably fixing the game so they can get another replay and more match receipts. And then it goes the other way. People are like, it's too cruel. It's too cruel on the players and it's a terrible way to lose and it's unfair and all that. So I don't think they can win. But in good news for my home county, Limerick, they're still in the championship and no doubt will come back hungrier after this. Wexford up. You probably heard the live draw there before the show. Wexford up next for the Treaty County. And as a result, I would like to introduce a boycott on all strawberries until the game is in the bag. Okay.
Seems fair. What else? It's the music festival that was, then wasn't, then was again.
Over the weekend, WhatsApp groups across the country were filled with rumours that the music festival Beyond the Pale was cancelled. But it turns out that rumours of its demise were greatly exaggerated because the organisers issued a new statement last night reaffirming that the festival will go ahead this weekend at Glendalough Estate in Wicklow, and have thanked people for bearing with us over the past 2 days. It all started on Saturday when word started spreading that the festival wouldn't be happening. It's a small festival, around 10,000 people, and set to be headlined by one of my favourite electronic acts, John Hopkins. Róisín Murphy is there as well. And I suspect that secretly when news was going out around it that it was cancelled, that there were people slightly relieved that they didn't have to go looking for a sleeping bag and check the weather forecast and all that stuff. So the good news is that Beyond the Pale is happening, and the organisers went on to say in their statement that they want to reassure everybody that the festival is secure and they are full throttle for next weekend and beyond. And they also said in their statement, a festival needs significant cash flow over the festival month. It's a huge challenge for all festivals in their first few years. And this week, an essential piece of expected finance that would have helped us through the period fell through. You can imagine getting that email in the morning. Whilst we had not made any announcement, they say, we were cancelling, we did have to pause the work that was happening on site. And as it happens, the online chatter led to us being approached by a very highly regarded operator who sympathised with the struggles of putting on events as an independent operator and offered to help. Isn't that great? See, that's another heartwarming moment that's happening out there all around us. So the festival is going ahead. There's such an eclectic mix of bands across all genres and eras. The festival does tend to attract maybe a little bit of an older crowd. And friends of mine who are due to go reluctantly admitted that when they thought the festival mightn't go ahead, they were secretly delighted as they, They were so afraid of their impending midlife hangovers that would have them rattling into the following Thursday. So, haha, you'll all have to go now and tell everyone you meet at the festival how you hardly drink anymore as you sit in a damp field and dream longingly about being at home on your couch watching Line of Duty repeats in your pyjamas.
Living your best life, eh? That's Dermot outing his friend's inner party animals as part of the Oliver Callan monologue this morning. If you find the online menu sorely tempting, but you're a bit short money-wise, what are you to do? Well, not ordering the food seems like a sensible choice, but why be sensible when you can enjoy that spice bag and take on more debt at the same time? Claire Byrne spoke to Adam Maguire from RTE's business desk about buy now, pay later for takeaway food delivery services.
It's a relatively new thing, Clarna, isn't it?
In Ireland, yeah. It's one of the main players offering what's called buy now, pay later. So a Swedish company. It's actually around 20 years old, but it only launched in Ireland just under 4 years ago.
You see it on every website now.
Yeah,
you can buy anything.
It's popped up everywhere, really, very, very quickly. It made all these partnerships with different retailers. And the way the buy now, pay later business works is that you buy something from a retailer which partners with Klarna, for example, and it's generally online, but not always online. When you get to the checkout, you're given the option to buy it outright, as you normally would, or you can break up the amount and pay it in installments over a number of weeks. So it might mean breaking up the purchase price into four equal payments spaced out over 6 weeks. So, for example, a €500 TV, you pay €125 on the day, and then in 2 weeks you pay another 125, 2 weeks another 125, and then 2 weeks. So over the course of then 6 weeks after the initial payment, you pay off the other, €375.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do that with no interest applied, no fees or charges or anything like that. You pay the same as you would if you just bought it up front, but you just spread out the payments. Klarna generally makes its money from getting a tiny little transaction fee, basically, from the retailer for handling this form of payment. So, in a way, it's kind of in the same spirit as the old hire purchase option that a lot of appliance retailers, you know, the Never Never, buying something on the drip that you would have done years and years ago. The big difference, I suppose, is generally it's done over a short period of time. It's not months and years. It's over a couple of weeks. And it's a relatively lower amount, and it's generally no or low cost. And being a fintech, it's designed to be as user friendly as possible, as easy to set up, so much lower barrier to entry. Customers can get spending on it very quickly. And I should say, Klarna isn't the only people offering this kind of option. Revolut, for example, offers a buy now, pay later option built into its app. It does have a small transaction fee, so it's not entirely free. Retailers like Very have versions of their own. There's also Hum, which is very much like the old hire purchase.
Oh yeah, people will have heard about it.
Yeah, and again,
well,
you see those signs all over retailers. Mm. Apple also offers this, but not in Ireland and other countries. So.
Okay, now is there anything wrong with using buy now, pay later? Because from what you've described there, if you're spreading it over a period of time and there's no interest, it might look benign enough.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. It's like some people liken it to a credit card, because just like them, you know, buy now, pay later, it's a general relatively small amount. It's unsecured, kind of what you might call an informal loan. And like a credit card, if you smart in the way you use it, you pay it back within the time frame. It won't necessarily cost you anything or cost you very much. And it could simply be just another tool for kind of managing your money and your expenses. But like a credit card, it does create an additional cost if you don't meet those repayment terms in time. You know, it could go from being free or very cheap to very expensive very, very quickly. And if you completely lose control of the debt, it could become a major problem for you. Like in the case of Klarna, for example, they warn customers that missed payments will incur a fee. And it also reserves the right to pass your bill onto a debt collector, which obviously could get very messy and very expensive very quickly. Now, anecdotally, I've heard that generally they tend to just write off the debt. So that, certainly if it's small, they just forget about it and they just block you from using the service in the future.
But don't rely on that.
Like the risk is there that, you know, they could put it in the hands of a very aggressive third party who will apply fees and charges and all that on top of the money you owe already. But even without getting to that stage, you know, not clearing a buy now, pay later loan in time could become expensive, because, you know, there are potentially fees and interests that kick in after a certain amount of time. One of the providers I looked at in Ireland, they offer interest-free payments for up to 6 months. If you fail to clear it by then, though, pretty much a 40% rate kicks in. So that you're in the kind of territory of the payday lender there, 40% interest rate on your debt.
Ooh.
And, you know, bear in mind, this kind of lending is generally, it's not done with a credit check. So that's part of what makes it accessible to people and so quick to get set up. But it also means the companies that are giving you the money don't necessarily know, you know, much about your financial history, your repayment capacity, what other loans you have. And, you know, the concern is, say, from the money advice and budgeting service, MABS, they fear that you could have a situation where you have what they call credit stacking. This is where people have multiple small loans spread across multiple providers. So maybe some buy now, pay later loans, maybe a couple of credit cards. And each on their own might be relatively small and easy to manage, but you pull them together and suddenly you could be talking hundreds or thousands worth of debt.
Yeah.
And when, when you're trying to handle all of those payments, it mounts up. Then the interest kicks in and it spirals out of control.
Yeah, and you add them all up and you've chewed in a good bit into your monthly income.
Exactly,
you know,
and you
income.
Don't have, and then because you're using your what money you can to pay off the debt, you don't have anything left. So you're more reliant then on borrowing more to kind of fund your day to day. So it becomes a spiral and people can get caught very quickly.
And it's really tempting because it's so easy to use and because there's no checks, like you said.
Yeah, very, you can set up within minutes, really. I think you need, you know, ID and a picture and that's about it to get set up on these things. But very easy to do it.
Do you really want to get in a hole just for the pleasure of having a nice takeaway on a Tuesday night?
And this is the kind of concern about it, because, you know, it's really a, in a way a new dynamic, because, you know, as cautious as you should be about any kind of borrowing, big or small, when you're buying like an appliance or even clothing, there's some tangible benefit. You have a product that you will hopefully have for a long time, long after you've repaid the debt that it cost you. But if you're borrowing for a coffee or a sandwich or your dinner, it's going to be gone within hours of you taking out the debt, and you're going to be paying for it for weeks or months later.
Can't even taste it anymore.
Yeah, you've forgotten all about, what do I owe that money for? It's gone. You know, you're never getting it back. So now Klarna has defended these kinds of partnerships with food delivery apps and says, well, people have been using overdrafts and credit cards to pay for coffees and takeaways for decades, and they've often faced charges on top of that would actually cost them more, whereas Klarna won't cost them anything if they pay it on time, which is true. But I'd say, you know, professional, you know, finance professionals would urge people not to do that. So that's
a bad practice. I've owned McGee's voice ringing yeah, in my head, you know, as I sit here.
So it's a bad idea to use a credit card to get a takeaway or a coffee. But that doesn't mean it's a good idea to use a buy now, pay later app either. That's also a bad idea.
If you can't afford it, don't buy it. That's what any financial advisor would say.
Yeah, right? But I mean, what this move by Klarna and DoorDash and Deliveroo here is being seen by some is a sign of problems that are kind of bubbling under the surface of the economy, especially in the US. You know, there, just like here, they've gone through a cost of living crisis. We saw how much the issue of petrol prices were in the presidential election. The price of eggs, still a major talking point there. And now we're seeing this prospect of consumer prices rising faster again in the months ahead because of Donald Trump's tariffs. And it's led to this buy now, pay later option becoming attractive to consumers, enough so that Klarna and DoorDash think, well, this is worth offering people. And of course, the internet had a lot of fun with this as well. Tons of memes based around the absurdity of the situation. You know, one tweet saying, you know, it's 2026, I defaulted on my burrito debt. Another talking about Taco Bell credit default swaps, lots of Big Short and Wolf of Wall Street references. But ultimately, finance experts feel that, you know, if you're borrowing money to pay for an everyday luxury like a coffee or a pizza or whatever it might be, maybe even the groceries, it's now attractive. It's maybe necessary in some people's minds for enough consumers. There is obviously something fundamentally wrong with the system, and things could get a lot worse very quickly.
Canary in the coal mine stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing to worry about though, right? Right? Adam Maguire from RT's business desk talking to Claire Byrne this morning about buy now, pay later services for food delivery orders. The penalty shootout that concluded the Munster final this weekend was not universally popular with supporters, as Katie Hannan found out when she spoke to Mary on this afternoon's Live Line.
Mary, will you hang on there a minute? Because I want people to remind people of this moment, which was putting people's hearts crossways on Saturday evening.
We're going level again in the Munster final. This ethnic encounter that goes on and on and on. Darragh Fitzgibbon from Charleville, right on the border between Limerick and Cork. It's 2:27 to 1:30. And for the first time ever, a Munster hurling final is going to be decided by penalty pucks. And the boos are ringing out for the supporters.
Yeah, look. I don't know. The greatest game in the world, once again, showing it again here tonight. Limerick and Cork have given it everything. I feel it's hard that it's going to penalties. But look, I suppose everyone will say on the programme, it says at the start, if this is full-time, I'm saying everyone's going to penalties, and they knew it was. So here we are now, lads.
That was, of course, Pádraig Lodge and Shane McGrath there, co-commentators on that match on Saturday. Absolute heart-stopping match. But yeah, I can hear the audiences or the spectators' response when it went to penalties at the end. Mary, Were you there, Mary?
No, Katie, I was there. It was just, it was a brilliant match. But Jesus, why did they not have a replay for the players? They gave everything to the match from both sides. You know, the penalties. Whoever invented these penalties? Have they ever played hold on themselves? It's a cruel way to get to lose. You know, I want to fair play to Cork, but like the heartbreak for the players on both sides to go to penalties. It should have gone to another game.
Now, Mary, I suppose, complete disclosure, you are a Limerick fan.
Oh, holy Jesus, I am a Limerick fan, but I wouldn't begrudge Cork now either, in all fairness. I am a Limerick fan. You know, it was heartbreaking. They gave everything. Both teams. There's nothing between the two teams. You know, but it's the penalty. It's the first time ever a game had got the penalties. Then, unfortunately, Limerick had to be involved in it. Sorry.
Well, I suppose the thing is, Limerick is always involved in it.
Yeah.
I'm just counting up. 16 finals you've been in the last 7 years. You've won six Munster finals, 5 All-Irelands, 3 National Leagues, 3 Munster Leagues. Sure, you have no notion at all of what it feels like to lose in any circumstances.
But it's not the losing side of it. It's the penalties. I would think the penalties, you should have went to another game. You should have put it on to another game, because imagine what the GA would have got. They could have full Croke Park if they took the Munster final to Croke Park in 2 weeks' time. Everyone would get the banter of it.
Oh, should that... I saw Jess Cattle actually tweeting that on Saturday. He was saying, you know, does it have to end like this? Imagine the anticipation and the crack and the buzz if we were looking forward to another final like that.
Another game. Yeah, I would give everybody a lift. But it was just down to the pin. It's a cruel way to finish a game. If there's anyone out there listening is over the GA, would they listen to think again? To change their mind finishing a game like that. It's a cruel way.
It's cruel.
And for the teams, the heartbreak.
But also,
and everything for the players.
Oh, the players though, Mary. I did feel awful sorry for every one of them stepping forward. That walk up with their hurl to take that penalty, like it's the pressure.
The pressure on it, like, and stuff, and it's cruel. It's a cruel way, you know. But look, if anyone there at the GA are listening, look, put on your thinking caps again. It was a brilliant best game ever of hurling. Never mind in Munster, in the whole country. It was fantastic.
Oh, it was.
But it's just down to the penalties. You know, for the players, the mental health after this, and how do they feel after going home and they're missing the what's going on. It's cruel.
It's not fair. I'm hearing, Mary, that you've been advised that the games mightn't be good for your health.
Oh, holy God, no. I get very excited. I get very excited, but that's me anyway.
But do you still go, Mary?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, I would still go. Yeah, I would still go. You know, okay, but I get very, very, very excited. The hat goes racing. It isn't good for the blood pressure.
It's not. No, definitely not the game that we had yesterday or on Saturday.
Definitely not anyway. But like, you know, like we can't. Our Limerick team. They're the best team that ever was invented in Ireland. And thanks down to John Kiley and the boys. They did us proud the other day. They did us proud. And so, and look, we're on and forward now to Dáil Éireann. You know what? We might meet Cork again in Dáil Éireann.
Wouldn't that be something? That's Limerick supporter Mary talking to Katie Hannan on this afternoon's Liveline about the Munster final at the weekend and how unhappy she and many other supporters were about the match being decided by penalties instead of going to a replay. Back on Oliver Callan and the subject of romanticy. You what now, gay? It's a portmanteau of romance and fantasy, I believe, and it's apparently having a moment. Dermot Whelan was joined by Scottish author Lauren Hamilton Murray, who recently signed a publishing deal for her romanticy story, and Dermot asked her to tell us, first of all, what romanticy is.
I would define romanticy as fantasy, but the romantic plotline is a lot more central to the story. Mm. It contributes to character development. It drives the plot. So it's really key.
Yeah. And is it something that you were interested in? What kind of books were you reading yourself as a kid?
I started with sci-fi and dystopian, and then I moved into fantasy, and then I discovered romantasy sort of during my late teens.
Mm. And is there a kind of a formula? Is there a winning formula? Or is it something that kind of just happens fluidly for you?
I have no idea. I didn't really have a process. I went into this completely blind, so I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah, well, it sure did, because you had publishers, battling each other to win over your affections, not unlike one of the characters in your book. What I loved about the book is, I know it's not aimed at me. I'm a tad older than the audience that you might be aiming at, because it is aimed primarily at young adults. But what I loved about it is that it reminded me of the kind of books that I used to read. And I used to love those role-playing fighting fantasy books, they were called. So it was all swords and armor and magic and potions and all that stuff. So it kind of took me back to my childhood. But if I could, would you mind if I read a few lines? Because I think this kind of sets the tone and the theme of the book. When I read this, I was like, oh yeah, this is great. This is going to be a fantastic book. Would you mind that?
No, of course.
Okay, so this is how the book sets off. And it says, "My mother made it to the very top of the tallest cliff, the sea heaving beneath her, the sky weeping above. She told me that I held out a tiny hand and closed it into a fist as if I was grasping a handful of the storm and keeping it like a secret. And just as it started, the rain stopped. She who called the storm quelled the storm." I thought that was a beautiful scene setter.
Thank you.
Yeah, could you talk us through the characters in the book and where the story takes us?
Blaze is a rain singer, so she has deadly rain magic, but she's born into a fire-wielding family. And when she was born, she summoned a devastating storm that resulted in the deaths of thousands of people. So for 17 years, she has been hidden away from the world and hated and feared by the people. Mm. But much to everyone's surprise, she, alongside her twin brother, Flint, is selected to compete in the Choosing Right, which is a dangerous competition for the crown. And she's taken to the Golden Palace, where she finds herself caught up in court intrigue and caught between two rival love interests.
Yeah. How do you know that? How do you know? You're able to describe it so succinctly. That's fantastic. The character of Blaze you mentioned, the main character, I gather she appeared to you as a character when you were just 12.
Yeah, she's been living in my head since I was 12. Mm. I always had imaginary friends when I was little, but this one really stuck. And I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently, but I do have this memory of looking out the car window while it was raining and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool to control the rain?
Wow, a Scottish person dreams of controlling weather. I think as Irish people, we can all relate to that. We've all looked out of a caravan window on our summer holidays going, oh, if only I could control the weather with my mind.
Completely.
Yeah. So you obviously had a very vivid imagination as a child. And you know what? It's hard to hang on to that. You know, I felt I was the same way. I was always writing kind of magical based stories, you know, when I was a kid. But as we get older and go through the grind of school and the buckle up now and focus on the exams and that kind of thing, a lot of us can lose touch with that more creative side of ourselves and that lovely imaginative flair. How do you think you managed to hang on to yours?
It actually became more important for me, reading in books during that time, because it was just such an escape. And I really needed books when I was a teenager. So I knew that when I was writing my book, I wanted to write for teenagers. It was really important to me.
And why do you think you needed the book so badly?
I think just because I was thinking about this the other day. Being a teenager, it's like being in a state of constant emotional whiplash, and you're not really sure who you are and you're trying to work it out. And I think having that refuge in books was just really important for me growing up.
Mm, I like that term, emotional whiplash. That's great. Did you just make that up now?
Not right now. It's actually in my acknowledgements.
Okay. I love it. Yeah, it's a beautiful way of describing it. You should be a writer. but yeah, I mean, were you obviously a sci-fi and kind of fantasy fan growing up, but did you continue to write short stories right through your teens? Did you keep writing, or was it just reading?
I wrote a lot of stories when I was quite young. Before I could even write, I would recite them out loud and force my family members to act as my scribes. And then and then when I was quite a young teenager...
You're not even going to write it down. You're like, take a note. I climbed to the mountain and the clouds gathered. Write this down, you.
I'd be like, grab a pen. And then I had this idea for the book in my head just because Blaze has been in my head for so long. So I'd write chapters here and there. But yeah, a lot of short stories. And then I decided, just because I love clearly making life easy for myself, to start writing this book while I was at university.
Yeah, so you studied English at University of Stirling and you were doing this in your spare time. And most students, you know, would find it hard to even motivate themselves to get to the library. Certainly if I think back to my own college years, I was trying to find the darkest corner of the buttery bar in Trinity so I could hide there without people judging me on a Tuesday afternoon. But you were squirreled away writing Heir of Storms. Did you do it at nighttime?
Yeah, so while my friends were out having fun, I would be writing this book because I was writing at the same time as my dissertation. So I would do a 9 to 5 working on that, and then I would come back to my flat and do a 9 to 5, but this time PM to AM working on this book.
What was your thesis about?
Jane Austen and her juvenilia, so her unpublished work from when she was a teenager.
Okay, so and did you see a little parallel between you both?
I hope so. That's a huge compliment.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, you're kind of kindred spirits in a way, you know, just following your heart and writing when you could. And so you're writing this stuff at nighttime. Did you think it was good? Did you hope it was good? Or was it merely an exercise in escaping the restrictions, I guess, of the study work and the, you know, the coursework that you were doing?
I hoped it was good. I tried to have more confidence in myself as I was going along, but I didn't really know what I was doing. I had no experience with writing an actual full-length book.
Mm. Did you keep it a secret?
Yes.
Is that hard to do?
Yes, I think everyone was wondering why I was just keeping to myself so much. But when I went home after uni and I finished it up during the summer, I did eventually tell my mum because I was just sitting in the garden at my laptop and she was shouting at me to get a job. And I was like, I'm writing a book.
Author Lauren Hamilton Murray talking to Dermot Whelan this morning about how she came to write her romantasy novel, Heir of Storms, which is published by Penguin. Back on the Today programme, and Clare Byrne was joined this morning by retired Dublin footballer Robbie Kelleher and historian Mark Duncan to talk about a new documentary series about Gaelic football, Hell for Leather. Clare asked Robbie about Dublin, who had been poor for years beforehand, winning the All-Ireland in 1974.
It just came from nowhere. We beat Wexford unconvincingly the first round, Loudon the second round. The big trick baked to us, Offaly. Offaly had been very successful in the early 70s. And we beat them in Croke Park, and from then it just grew. And, you know, from, you know, 200 people in Croke Park watched it, suddenly we had 70,000 people in Croke Park.
It was wild.
It was incredible. And the colour and everything. That before 74, you didn't have flags and things like that, you know. And then suddenly, the day of the All-Ireland in 74, I remember walking out of the tunnel of the dressing room during the minor match and just looking up at Hill 16 and just saying, wow, what the colour was just amazing.
And I'm sure the experience of the wall of sound from Hill 16 was something you remember as well.
It was incredible, yeah. And there wasn't great barriers in those days. My great memory of the last, near the end of the 74 when it was clear, final when it was clear we were going to win, Heffo was down at Hill 16 end, it was sweet afternoon in his mouth, and he's trying to keep the spectators back from running onto the pitch. So it was amazing.
Yeah.
And after the match, the pitch was crowded, and some fella came on anyway, and he grabbed the crest off my jersey,
ripped it off. Sign of the times. Now, Mark, the series goes right back though. Way, way back before we had the GAA. And it's fascinating to see that story and the origins of football. Kick them home was a thing between parishes.
Kick them home, I think that refers to the game of CAD, which was particularly popular in parts of Kerry, played during the winter, would have been played between neighbouring parishes or districts. You know, it was played across fields, across ditches, across hedges. Mm-hmm. The ball would have been an inflated pig's bladder covered with animal skin. And the winning team was the team which actually did carry the ball back to their own home parish.
And anyone could turn up. There were no rules really to speak of, were there?
Rules in a very kind of broad sense, you know. I suppose the fact is, if you look even kind of further back, you will find reference to forms of folk football in Ireland through the centuries. I mean, you find it in legal records, you'll find it in newspaper accounts, in travellers from outside of Ireland who come to Ireland and they witness football in as they're travelling through the country. You'll find it in literary sources. Mm-hmm. There's a great account. There's an epic 550-line poem from 1721 by a man called MacConcannon, which describes a game of football out in North County Dublin. Sometime around that period between Lusk and Swords, and the teams are dressed in white and they're identified by having ribbons in their caps at that stage. So football did exist. It didn't exist in the form that we came to know it. And it's really, I suppose, you know, when I mentioned CAD had an awful lot of similarities to what became the early game of Gaelic football, but also the early game of rugby. And I suppose it's important to bear in mind that there were more than one types of football. Mm-hmm. And the GAA was not the first sporting organisation to the party when it came to organising football.
But when Gaelic football became formalised, the GAA happened, they must have wondered, will this take off? Will anyone be interested in this? Just tell us how quickly it grew legs and became popular.
Cusack had the famous line that the GAA spread like a prairie fire. And that is literally the way it was in 1885, 1886. It grew absolutely rapidly. Now, the GAA is not just promoting Gaelic football and hurling during those periods. It's also, you know, the principal organising body for athletics. So the essence of the GAA's appeal is that it was providing a really kind of distinctive kind of day out for Irish people. You know, on any programme on a Sunday afternoon, you could get a series of hurling matches, football matches, athletic contests. And there were also bands and all sorts of pageantry around the game as well. And it's important to bear in mind it was also taking place on a Sunday, the traditional day of rest for an awful lot of people in rural Ireland, people who would have been traditionally excluded from other types of pastimes where they were held on Saturdays.
Yes, so, because they were working.
They were working.
And weren't available. But now it became a thing that you go to Mass and then you go to the match.
You could go to Mass, you could go to the match. It was Maurice Davin, who actually founded the rules for Gaelic football, was the first president of the GAA, you know, who said we needed to bring sport within the reach of people born to no other inheritance than an everlasting round of labour, you know. And there's a wonderful account from a newspaper in 1885 about the Phoenix Park. You know, we're seeing people now playing in the Phoenix Park who were never playing there before. We're talking about working people in the city, you know.
Yeah, and just going back to your time, Robbie, in the 70s, you mentioned how unpopular the team was in the lead up to 74. That's because soccer was the thing, isn't it? Everyone wanted to play soccer in Dublin at that time.
Football was absolutely dead. I mean, I often tell the story of a friend of mine who's a teacher in Joey's in Marino, which was hotbed at GAA, and he went into a class of 15-year-olds one day and asked them, could he name anybody on the Dublin team? And not one kid in the class could name one fellow on the Dublin team. They could have named the Leeds United reserve team at the time. So it was seen as kind of an ignorant game that Colchis played.
God, love us.
And George Best and Dennis Law were the idols. Then suddenly after 74, Jimmy Keaveney and Brian Mullins and Paddy Cullen, they were up there with the George Bests and Johnny Giles of this world. You know,
in the programme there's a lovely narrative about Kevin Heffernan in 1955 and his regrets and the sadness that he carried with him and the frustration from that loss that time that maybe reversed for him nearly 20 years later.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin never felt you never really won an All-Ireland unless you beat Kerry on the way. So we beat Galway in 74 and then we were hot favourites against Kerry in 75 and They turned us over. But then when we beat them in 76, that was it for Kevin. That was his lifetime ambition achieved. And he just packed it up after that. He said, hey, I've done everything
he's,
now.
He ticked the box.
We ticked the box. We've beaten Kerry in an All-Ireland final. Yeah.
And for you then and what it meant, because there's a lot of that in the programme, that once you achieve something like you and your teammates did, that your place in history is certain and guaranteed. Do you feel that?
Not really. I think it's very different in Dublin, in a metropolitan city at the size of Dublin. Like, if I was a star Kerry player and I walked down the middle of Tralee or Killarney, everybody would know who I was. If I walked down Grafton Street, nobody would know who I was, you know. I'm more likely to be recognised in Tralee or Killarney than in Grafton Street. So it's a bit different. We'd agree. But I was very fortunate to be part of a great team at an exceptional time. Do I feel in part of history? No, not really.
Mark. You are, Robbie.
I'm delighted you said it.
He's undoubtedly part of history. I think, Robbie's team was the one that lit my imagination when I was a very young kid. I would have been very young when they were winning, but actually, Robbie talked about the colour at the games, but actually it was also played out on colour television. Colour television was quite new in Ireland at the time, you know, and All-Ireland semi-finals and finals.
What I think we did do was change the course of GAA, particularly in Dublin, but I think even nationwide, you know, I think the image of the GAA changed very considerably out of the Dublin-Kerry rivalry that existed in the 1970s.
Former Dublin footballer Robbie Kelleher talking about Gaelic football with historian Mark Duncan on Today with Clare Byrne this morning. The five-part documentary series Hell for Leather, The Story of Gaelic Football, starts tonight at 9:35 on RTÉ1 television and on the RTÉ player. Ray Darcy only found out that he was interviewing Pulp frontman Jarvis Cocker, he tells us, about a half an hour before going on air this afternoon. So there couldn't have been much prep time put in ahead of the call, but the two veterans of their trades had a grand old chat, dropouts not included, covering a lot of ground, starting with More, the first new album from Pulp in 23 years.
It was because, you know, we got together, we were playing some concerts in 2023, and there was a song that I'd written for a play back in England, a play called Light Falls by a playwright called Simon Stevens. And because it was written and we had a string section with us, we kind of worked out an arrangement and we would try it in sound checks. And then we eventually played it when we played in Sheffield. And that was the start of it, really.
Yeah. You were saying that you're a slow worker and you sort of said that jokingly, but you're known for your procrastination over lyrics.
Yeah.
Yes. And how did you get around that this time?
I used to write things down in a notebook, but now I tend to, like everybody, just have notes on my phone. And when, after doing the Hymn of the North, I thought, okay, I'll have a look at what I've been writing over the last few years and try to sort things into kind of themes or ideas. And that was the start of the lyrics for this record.
Old and new given equally rapturous welcome. The review in The Guardian today of your Glasgow gig.
Yeah, well, that's very nice to see that written in black and white. Yeah, it's something that, you know, Pulp haven't had to think about for a long time. You know, we've been playing and the big challenge was to get the old songs sounding as they should. And also because, you know, I'm older than I was. And so when you play a song and you're trying to revive it, you've got to, it's not just a case of learning the notes and stuff. You have to try and get back into the feeling of it and make sure that it comes back to life. And that's, you know, that had been what we've been doing for the last couple of tours. But then when you're suddenly faced with putting new songs amongst old ones, then of course you're thinking, well, hope they like them. So it was very good to see that written down in a review. Yeah.
Yeah. So he says here that you finished up with Common People, then came back for an encore with Sunset, which is a beautiful song, co-written by Richard Hawley.
Yeah.
With a nod to the Coke ad from the 70s.
Yeah, we've had to pay for that.
Oh, did you?
Well, Richard sent me some chords. He'd written something on the guitar and he said, oh, it sounds a bit like that Coke advert. I said, oh, that's all right. And then I just thought, because he'd put it in my mind, I thought, oh, well, I'll quote a line from that song. Anyway, I've paid for it now. So we've had to give them some of the publishing on it.
So did you volunteer paying it or did they come after you?
No, we realised that we got in touch with them and we came to an arrangement, shall we say. Yeah.
You were talking about singing the old songs and getting back into them. Does that keep you young?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one thing is that, you know, I thought the band had played a trick on me when we first started rehearsing for this tour. I thought that they were playing the songs in a higher key because I was finding it so hard to get the notes. And obviously, you know, you're not really aware of it as you're living your life, but your voice gets deeper and deeper and deeper as you get older. And so I had a choice then. I could have said, OK, let's change the key. But something said to me, well, why don't you just try and get back so you can sing them in the original key? Because I think then you have got a chance of bringing it back to life and of getting the energy that was in the song when it was written. So that's what I decided to do. And weirdly enough, the only song that I can't get all the notes of is Help the Aged. We haven't played that for a long time. And I have to get the audience to sing the last line of the chorus for that. But that's kind of fitting, you know. They are actually helping the aged, as in they're helping me to sing the song.
And ye performed together firstly as a band in 1980. And then I suppose you came to most people's radar mid-1990s. My first experience of you was Babies from His and Hers, which was on one of those alternative compilations. I played it over and over again. So you were doing what you were doing for 15 years before you hit the charts.
Yeah, but I mean, I did other things, you know. I thought it was over when I went to London. You know, I moved to London in 1988 to go to art college, St. Martin's, and I just thought that would be the end of it. But then Steve Mackey, who was from Sheffield and I knew him a bit, he joined the band. And we really, you know, we had 2 years where we only did one concert per year. So we were almost gone, but I don't know. When it came to the end of college, played a concert and suddenly people seemed to like us a bit. So I never bothered to try and be a filmmaker, which is what I'd gone to college to learn how to be. I went back to being in the band.
Yeah, you say in the lyric of one of the songs, born to perform, it's a calling. I exist to do this.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, that's part of getting older, isn't it? Like realising what you can do and what you can't do, you know. And I enjoy being on stage. It, like I say, I like that thing of bringing the songs to life, but also it kind of brings me to life a bit. You know, I am not a massively outgoing person. But then when you're in front of an audience, you've got to, you know. So I managed to access a different part of myself, you know. I'm not like being a different person, but it does bring something out of me that I don't get that from anything else.
Yeah, I was reading there that an ex of yours said that the only really get to hear the real Jarvis when he's on stage. Is that true?
Yeah, that used to be the case, and I am a bit ashamed of that. I have to say now, my wife was the first person to hear this record, so I got better with that because I realised, it took me a long time to realise it, but I realised it wasn't really very nice that people who you were in relationships with didn't know what was going on in your mind. So I decided that she had to hear the songs first. And that was, I know it's a very simple thing, but it was quite important to me to have done that.
So maturing, you know, growing up.
Eventually, growing up, that's a good way of putting it. Not, on the back of one of our albums, This Is Hardcore, it said, it's okay to grow up as long as you don't grow old. And I still think that, you know, because to me, growing up is learning more about life, learning more about yourself. Growing old is more like just giving up, just saying I'm old, I'm not involved anymore, you know. So, I'm growing up. I hope I'm not growing old.
Yeah, Grown Ups is a song on the new album as well. Because you said, like, Mowgli, why was everybody praising Mowgli for leaving the jungle? You would have stayed in the jungle because he was having the crack.
Well, that's what I used to think when I was a kid. It was like, yeah, hang around with a talking bear and all that kind of stuff, rather than like becoming a member of normal human society.
Yeah.
I would have just carried on hanging out with the bear for sure.
Yeah, you mentioned your mate Steve Mackey, who died in 2023, the bass player. So, so you were there from, you know, from your late teen and early 20s. It's a long relationship, so that must have hurt you when he died.
Yeah, he did, and he was a real, like I say, he really kind of kept the band together. When if I'd have come to London and he hadn't have been there, I think the band would have just fizzled out then.
Mm.
And he was very kind of a driven person, so he was very good for the band, and so I owe a lot to him, and it was a big thing, yeah.
Pulp's Jarvis Cocker remembering the band's bassist Steve Mackey, who died in 2023, as well as talking about More, the first new album from Pulp in 23 years, and lots besides, on this afternoon's Ray D'Arcy Show. Finally, on this episode of Playback Daily, it's the time of year when many people find themselves panic buying for their fast approaching holidays. But Claire Byrne asked us this morning, could the perfect pair of shorts be lurking at the back of our wardrobe? Claire was joined in contemplating how to have a slow fashion summer by Joe Linehan, editor of the Climate Supplement with the Sunday Times Ireland.
So the first thing to do then is audit what you have from last year and previous years, right?
Yes, I love to say to everyone to do a stock take, because I am the same. We all have things that are hidden away in our home. We'll go out and say, oh, I definitely need a new pair of shorts. Then you'll go home and you'll be digging through things and you'll think, oh my God, I actually have three denim shorts here. So the first thing to do is to sit down, go through your wardrobes, figure out what you have and what you need and what you love. And then maybe if there's things that no longer wear, maybe you can donate those. And then if you really are at a place where you do need something, you know, I always think people want a brand new, lovely, white, fresh cotton t-shirt. That's something that maybe you do want to go out and get. But do your stock take first and figure out what you have and what you actually need.
Do you think the summer season, and when you're shopping for holidays in particular, that that's when the temptation is highest to buy the cheaper fast fashion bits? Because really you're looking at something that you only really wear for 2 or 3 weeks of the year, right?
Completely. Like, this might be the only time that you wear those items, because unfortunately we do not get the weather here. So I think you're right. I think people kind of think in their heads, okay, I'm not going to make a big investment money wise, but I would like something fresh and new. So then you do maybe go to your cheaper retailers and you're picking up pieces that are, let's be honest, made from synthetic materials. They're made from petroleum. They're not made from great materials. They're not really going to last, not going to wear very well. Because of that reason, you think, well, I'm not really going to use it, so I'll go cheap and cheerful.
Mm-hmm. Particularly, I suppose, as well, when you're shopping for t-shirts and shorts for children for their summer holidays, you kind of, you know, you're not expecting those things to last, but maybe we need to turn that on its head really and buy, you know, as little as we possibly can and do expect it to last, so you can either donate it or sell it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we can kind of get into that mind frame of thinking, okay, I do need to buy a few bits, but maybe I'll buy quality things that I'll be able to pull out year after year. And when I bring them out, I'm only wearing them once a year. So when I see them, they are like meeting a new friend, because I can't even remember the last time I wore them. And then especially when it does come to things like kids wear, like, that must be so difficult for parents and families. You're spending so much money buying these bits and they might have grown out of them by next summer. So what do you do? So that comes down to then what you've mentioned, which is maybe starting to open your mind to reselling and buying secondhand. You know, Vinted is a fabulous platform. It was huge in the UK and Europe, all over the world. It's only just launched in Ireland this year, and already so many people have gotten on board. And what I would say to people is, if you have those pieces, when you're doing your stock take, if you've got kids' pieces, if you have pieces of your own that are in great condition, but you're just not going to wear them, it's such a brilliant opportunity to pop them up online, take a few pictures with your smartphone, sell those pieces and have that little bit of pocket money. And then it works the other way around. You know, maybe you want something fresh and shiny for the holiday, but you don't want to buy really bad quality and you don't maybe want to support a fast fashion retailer. Going onto these platforms like Vinted and Depop is fantastic. And what I think is really great about them is that before, when we talked about buying secondhand, everyone had this idea that they had to get up, they had to drive to a charity shop, they had to trawl through things. Whereas with these platforms, it really is the same as shopping online. You go into your search bar, you can search for the brands or the shops that you love, your size, and then you can filter through those items. So it's actually a very enjoyable shopping experience, which I think wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. So that is tempting people to maybe do it if they hadn't done it previously.
And there's people selling things on there that will have the labels attached that they'll never have worn. You know, there's no reason really not to. And you're getting them a great discount as well on those platforms, aren't you?
You really are. And I would say, like, I think especially when it comes to maybe items that are a bit trendy, you're like, I do love a trend. But if I want a trend, I do buy secondhand. For instance, cowboy style is really big this summer. I'm watching all the Beyonce concert outfits. I really wanted a pair of cowboy boots. So I set my alerts on Vestiaire Collective, which is the site for maybe a little bit more expensive items, designer items. I set my alert for a pair that I really wanted. They came up last month and I got them at an absolute steal. And I love them. But I was able to justify that kind of trendier item because I wasn't going out to buy it new. You know, I'm going to really enjoy wearing them, but I was buying it secondhand, which has such a lower environmental impact.
Mm-hmm. Do you caution, though, that, you know, you could go mad buying on those sites as well and actually defeat the purpose, you know, what
completely.
We're talking about here? Don't overdo it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, we like you mentioned at the start of the slot, we are way above average in Ireland for our shopping. Like, we love to buy a new outfit. We're at double the consumption of fashion than our EU counterparts. We love getting dressed up here, which is a fabulous sign of us. We really take pride in how we look. We love an occasion. But you're right, you can go the other way too. Even if you're buying secondhand, you can overconsume that way too. It is just being a little bit more cautious, I suppose, when you're approaching shopping and just thinking, what do I need to spend on? Can I be a bit savvy here? And then if I am going to buy something, how can I make sure that I'm going to really get what I need out of that clothes? You know, is it going to last? Is it going to wear well? That's the mindset that we're perhaps trying to get into.
What do you say to those who will say to you, well, I just have to go into a shop. It's my holidays. It's part of the celebration. Do you buy that argument?
Look, I think one of the hardest things to do is to really unfurl ourselves from the habits that we've gotten into. And I think it's really hard on consumers. I mean, everyone's on their smartphone. There is no way to escape the literal thousands of ads that bombard us every single day. We have been trained to think that if we're going away or if we've had a tough week or if we're going out, that we deserve this treat. And, you know, for some people, maybe that is their outlet. Maybe that is what they love to do. And I completely understand that. And I don't think there should be any shame or guilt with it. It takes a long time for us to maybe change our mindsets. But what I would say is maybe stop and think, because even though maybe you say to yourself, oh, I'm only spending 30 quid. Like, if you're spending that every single week on things that you're not wearing, that really, really adds up. That could be a fabulous night away. That could be a spa break. So I think it's trying to equate that maybe treat, inverted commas, in a different way. You know, if you're getting a real joy out of something and you love shopping and you're really using that item, that is money well spent. But a lot of the time, like you said, you've got items in your closet you forgot you bought, have the tag still on. That is like throwing money away. So I think if you can maybe rebalance it, like I always say to people, if you can say to yourself, okay, I'm not going to buy any fashion this month, but every time I get the urge and say I see something and it was, you know, 45 quid, I'm going to put that money aside. And at the end of the month, I'll have my 150, 200 quid and I'll spend that on something nice for myself. I think it's trying to reframe that, because we really have been trained to just go out and buy the cheap thing. But if that adds up over time, it's actually not a cheap thing and it really is such a waste.
Yeah.
That's Jo Linhan, editor of the Climate Supplement with the Sunday Times Ireland, telling us all how to have a slow fashion summer on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this tired and emotional edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday. And all together, down, down, deeper and down, look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.